Welcome back. You're listening to Policy and Pino, an ongoing series of conversations on Rodan Public Radio in concert with the beautiful Providence Athenaeum. Joining me is Rhode Island House Republican Leader Brian Newberry, Democratic consultant Kate Coyne McCoy, and Rodan Public Radio political analyst Scott McKay. We've been talking now national politics. We're going to shift our attention back to the Ocean State now. Governor Gina Raimondo is approaching the midpoint of her four-year term in office. Brian Newberry, how do you assess the governor's job performance?
I think the jury's still out on that. I've often said this repeatedly. I've said it on your show as well. I think there's really three in Rhode Island. There's really three political parties. Two of them call themselves Democrats, but there's three political parties. And they have three different philosophies of how you should, as a government, try to engender economic growth. Gina Raimondo clearly falls into the camp of, on the Democratic side, of trying to use government, I don't want to use the word stimulus, but government credits, dollars to try to lure in large companies. And if that works, that's fantastic. Maybe it will work. I don't subscribe to that theory myself. I think it tends to be, corporate welfare is a pejorative term, but that's the term I like to use. But we don't know if that's going to work until some time has passed. So in terms of the economy, I'd have to rate her performance up in the air. The other issues really are, I think the economy dominates the problems in this state, so I'll leave it at that.
Kate Coyne McCoy, as we noted earlier, you operated a super PAC that backed Gina Raimondo in 2014, so I expect you to be very supportive of the governor. And I don't think anyone doubts her work ethic. She certainly works hard and is very smart, and I think most people would give her credit for good intentions. At the same time, there have been some troubled issues. The state tourism rollout was a fracas, and now we see a lot of problems with the rollout of the state's new computer system for human service benefits. How do you assess the governor's performance, and why has the something less than competence been exhibited on some of these rollouts?
Look, she ran as the jobs governor, and she's creating jobs. Businesses are taking a fresh look at this state. GE just hired a bunch of people. Many from Rhode Island. Electric Boat is poised to hire maybe thousands of new employees, many that are developing skills because of Gina's new workforce initiatives. We have a future here and some hope in the job market that we haven't had in Rhode Island for a long time. The thing that, and I am biased about Gina, but the thing that amazes me about her, aside from her incredible, tireless, relentless promotion of Rhode Island, is that, you know, she does not give up, and she admits a mistake and moves on. The tourism thing, was it great? No. Did it, you know, linger for months? No. Find a problem, fix it, move on. She's creating jobs. She said she would. She has.
Scott McKay, you've seen a lot of Rhode Island governors over the years. How do you think Governor Raimondo is doing?
I give her an A for energy and effort because she's really out there and trying to do things. But some of the things Kate points to, like the jobs of Electric Boat, Gina Raimondo has absolutely nothing to do with creating any of those jobs. It's the federal defense budget. It's basically Jack Reed, Jim Langevin, they're both on the Armed Services Committees, and they're there to protect that. As far as GE goes, well, it's nice, but it's kind of window dressing. What she did do well, and this is kind of like we got the booby prize, she went after GE, which obviously wasn't going to move to Rhode Island when faced with Boston or Chicago or other major league cities. But you have to give her some credit. I wish somehow we'd stop looking for silver bullets in this state and just invest in education, things we know that work, education, skills training. We try to give families, particularly some of our younger, poorer families, through the increased income tax credits, things like that, that she's nibbled around the corners at. But still, we're behind in a lot of the help we give to families. We're behind the other New England states.
Okay, and she's raised the minimum wage twice.
Wait a
increased
minute.
Increased the EITC.
And our minimum wage is still $1.40 an hour, lower than Massachusetts.
EIT.
The earned income tax credit for,
but we're not as high as other states.
For working families, she's raised it twice.
A little tiny bit.
All right.
Every third grader, the reading program.
We're going to move.
Take SATs
Kate Coyne
for
McCoy.
Free. I could go on.
I know. We know you could go on.
So
could I know you both could go on, but we're going to move on here. Kate, Governor Raimondo told us at Rhode Island Public Radio she plans to run for re-election in 2018. Brian Newberry, who's the Republican candidate going to be?
You know, it's a good question. It will not be me. I'll say that right now. I don't know the answer. Yeah, no, I don't know the answer to that one. I mean, Ken Block obviously still has an interest in running. There's been rumors about John Hisenwhite running, and I haven't.
He's not
going to
do it. I talked to him last night.
Well, that's what he says now, right? I don't know.
Says
I mean,
absolutely not.
Alan Fung may run again. I don't know. I mean, the answer to your question is I do not know. I'm sure there'll be somebody. There always is someone that steps up, and sometimes they win, and sometimes they don't.
Let's move on and talk about the marquee legislative race of 2016. This is being fought out in Cranston, although it has statewide implications. Republican Stephen Frias is running against House Speaker Nicholas Mattiello, a Democrat, and it looks like a competitive race. Scott, how do you see this breaking down? And what's at stake here?
Well, you know, if you're a speaker, you're the lightning rod for all kinds of things that go wrong at the State House. It's always been that way. And I think to the extent that that has happened, that's why Mattiello looks vulnerable. And particularly when his number two, the very influential House Majority Leader, John DeSimone in Providence, lost his primary, then obviously the spotlight's on him. I think two things are at stake here. One is the people in Cranston. Do they really want to toss out the speaker and all the patronage, legislative grants, and things like that that you get? The other thing is, has Mattiello lost touch with his district to the extent that DeSimone did? DeSimone didn't have an election for like 20 years, and he never walked the district, whereas Mattiello is kind of his district. He's Italian-American. He was a church lector at Immaculate Conception until he got bounced out after supporting same-sex marriage. You see him a lot around the district. He's tried ways to reach out to the progressives also in little ways, putting Chris Blazejewski in there, hiring Matty Jurcik. So we'll see. I think he's got a tough race on his hands.
Brian Newberry, it certainly would be a big thunderbolt if Stephen Frias was to defeat Speaker Mattiello, but we know that four of your Republicans in the House decided not to seek re-election. That makes the task of building Republican ranks more difficult. Are Republicans putting too many eggs in the basket of Stephen Frias?
Well, I'll try to answer your question succinctly because I have time constraints. I think when we look at General Assembly races in this state, we sometimes forget that these are very local races. Very local. The most number of people who have ever voted in one of my campaigns was 7,200. The least was 5,200. I think that was the last time. And so party labels become less important than, number one, whether the person is well-known or whether they're an incumbent. Incumbents tend to win, regardless of political party in this state. Once they get in, they tend to stay there. Open seats become highly contested. So to get back to your question, and what Scott was touching on is, have you lost touch with your district, regardless of who you are? And what are the demographics of your district? And this is the most interesting point to me. At the end of the day, people who are registered Republicans tend to vote Republican. People who are registered Democrats tend to vote Democrat. Most people in the state are unaffiliated, but how they're spread throughout the various House and Senate districts varies widely. Nick Mattiello's district is the 10th most Republican-friendly district of 75 in the House. Mine is number 14. So there's a certain base for a Republican candidate in his district, and he's getting a very strong challenge. So the question becomes what Scott said. Is he still connected to his district, and do they want to get rid of the speaker? Do they see him as a lightning rod for what they don't like on Smith Hill? It wouldn't shock me if he loses, but I'm certainly not going to make any predictions. I don't want him to win and then come back and get mad at me for saying that.
Kate Coyne McCoy, you're a supporter of gun control, or what some people now call gun safety, and Speaker Mattiello is backed by the NRA with, I believe, an A or an A-plus rating. Do you have any sympathy for the cause of Republican Stephen Frias taking on the person who holds what is often called the most powerful political post in the state?
Speaker Mattiello was a major obstacle to passage of a very common sense piece of legislation that would have kept guns out of the hands of criminals and domestic abusers. It would have passed had he not blocked it. Stephen Frias may win. He's not going to be speaker, which means he has no great, he's got a great NRA rating too. He's not going to be with us on gun issues. But he won't be speaker.
Didn't that measure pass to keep guns
The piece of legislation that passed was absolutely useless and trotted out at the last minute to make it look like the legislature did something. They actually did nothing and instead brought up a piece of legislation at the very last minute that would have allowed concealed carry weapons to be attained with greater ease.
Let's come back here to House Republican Leader Brian Newberry. Brian, as we know, this is kind of a perennial issue. Republicans hold less than 20 seats in the 113-seat legislature. Many people think it would be better for the civic health of Rhode Island to have a more competitive two-party system. What's wrong? What's holding the Republican Party back?
Well, as I said earlier, incumbents tend to win, and Democrats have had a large majority for a very, very long time. Your point about civic culture is very important, though. One of the problems with the Rhode Island General Assembly is whoever the speaker is has way, way too much power. And I'm not going to single out Speaker Mattiello, it's true, Speaker Fox, Speaker Murphy, Speaker Harwood. Whoever the speaker is just needs to put together a majority to get anything done. And on the budget, that's two-thirds, but they have to put together a majority. And if they don't need their excess, in this case, Democrats, they don't have to listen to them. If, for example, there's 75 members in the House, if you had 49 Democrats, that's still a large majority, but guess what? They need a Republican vote to pass a budget. All of a sudden, they have to listen to their members more. They have to listen to us more. Even routine legislation, they can have people, you know, fight with them and agree to break off. It's not about liberal or conservative. It's about a healthy civic culture. That's the problem. The reality is legislative politics is a team game. When you get elected, you end up on a team. You don't have to like your team. You don't have to always agree with your team, but you got to fight with the team, and that's the only way you actually have influence. No one person has influence except the Speaker of the House because the rules are set to their advantage.
Scott McKay, what do Rhode Island Republicans need to do differently to gain more legislative seats?
Well, obviously, they've got to run good candidates. They've got to raise money for them. They've got to organize. The Republican Party doesn't have the infrastructure that the Democrats have, and particularly labor unions. I often feel that small business ought to be a real ally of Republicans. But what happens is these folks would rather be on their boats in August, and I don't blame them, playing golf. They don't want to walk a district. This is hard, 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 gritty work. And a lot of business people just say, you know, I'm just going to hire a lobbyist and buy what I need up there. And, you know, that's how it works. We're never going to have a good party. The other problem, I don't like to see Brian, how he thinks about this. The Republican Party in New England, in every New England state except a little bit in New Hampshire and even there, has lost a lot of its relevance in the last 20 or 30 years as the party nationally has gravitated to the Sun Belt and the states of the old Confederacy. And they look at this national party, and it doesn't look like anybody in New England wants to support it anymore. In fact, since 1992, only once has any state in New England voted for a Republican presidential candidate, and that was in 2000 in New Hampshire when Gore lost the state by only 7,000 votes because Ralph Nader picked up 25,000.
How about it, Brian?
No, I think, number one, Scott's right about that. My daughter goes to school in North Dakota. I've spent some time out there. It's the opposite out there. The Democratic Party out there is just atrophying. I mean, that goes back to the polarization issue and all that. The other problem you raised is exactly that. Every year I say, every campaign year, we leave seats on the table because we have people we know we can beat, but we can't find a good candidate who wants to run. They don't want to step up. They don't want to run. They don't want to do the work. It takes a tremendous amount of work to win as a challenger. That's a huge problem. But also the infrastructure issue is a good one, too. One of the dirty secrets, I don't know if this is how commonly known this is or not, but you know, the Speaker's office, as you saw in the Projo, they have their volunteers. They're people who work for the State House, but they volunteer on their free time, and they run the campaigns of many of the Democratic incumbents.
You're talking about staffers who work in the Speaker's office.
Look at any campaign finance report. They were just published. Look at any campaign finance report, and you will find the number of people who work in the General Assembly at the State House who donate to the Speaker, the Majority Leader, et cetera, is immense. They donate their money, and then they volunteer their time to work on campaigns. They organize the campaigns. They hire pollsters. They run PACs. We on the Republican side, we have none of that. And by the way, I tell my own staff people are not allowed to donate to us. They're not allowed to work our fundraisers. Go to the Speaker's fundraiser sometime and see who's taking checks at the door. It's the people working in the office upstairs. That's got to stop.
You're raising the specter of queasy politics, Brian Newberry. So let's dive in. The last legislative session was punctuated by the resignation of former House Finance Chairman Ray Gallison of Bristol. He remains part of an ongoing investigation. Providence Representative John Carnevale was found by the Providence Board of Canvassers not to be a legal voter in his Providence district. We know there's going to be a ballot question this November to strengthen the Ethics Commission, but I don't think that anyone expects that to be a panacea. Kate Coyne McCoy, what would it take to have a better, more diligent General Assembly?
You know, at the risk of heresy, I do think more closely, more Republicans, more Republican, more dissident voices in the legislature would be good. But at the end of the day, we need ethics reform. Buddy Cianci, Frank Gallison, Gordon Fox, you know.
Ray Gallison.
We need ethics reform here. And we're not going to solve the problems until we have it. I also think we need a line item veto for the governor.
Scott McKay, as we know, you have been watching the horrors and joys of Rhode Island politics for a long time, and I think you're a little skeptical on the impact of the Ethics Commission by itself, but what else do you think would be salutary for the health of the body politic?
I think the Ethics Commission thing is somewhat window dressing. I'm calling it the Ray Gallison Amendment. This was only put forward after Gallison got caught with his hands in the cookie jar, and I think that's kind of sad because they had this provision up for 5 or 6 years. I don't blame the House people, but it was the Senate that really was against it, and it got held up for a long time. I think maybe marginally, you know, it might help a little bit. But I really think that it's hard to beat a good two-party system. It really is and I also think maybe it's time to think about some different ways of doing it. Maybe term limits, maybe a full-time legislature. I don't know. All I know is there's been too many instances lately, and since I've been covering this thing, which goes back, as you know, I think Eisenhower was president when I started, but no. I mean, there have been too many instances where politicians have violated the voters' trust.
Let's go back to Brian Newberry here. Brian, as you talked about the importance of civic culture earlier, oftentimes votes in the House chamber or in House committees have all the drama of a Moscow show trial. What would it take leadership to diffuse some of its power to rank and file members?
Well, I mean, we could have a whole hour-long discussion. It's really rather dry. It goes back to what the House rules. I'm sure in the Senate, I really don't know the Senate rules. I'm sure they're similar, but I've never read them. The House rules provide the speaker with basically almost unlimited power so long as he doesn't lose the confidence of his members, but he can keep the confidence of his members by refusing to do what they want to do, by threatening not to do it. So it's a very dry and technical question you just asked, and I'm not sure you want to get my 10-minute answer, but I've had those conversations more than 10 minutes privately with a lot of Democratic members, and if there's ever a change in leadership, maybe we'll see some opening up of the process. I certainly hope so.
And what about the voters? I mean, we saw a significant upset in the primary with John DeSimone being defeated, but at the same time, there are many people who just tune out politics. What responsibility do they bear?
Well, competitive elections matter, whether it's a primary or a general election. Competitive elections make people better reps. I'm lucky this year I don't have an opponent, but this is the first time in 7 elections I haven't. And I'm still out, and I'm still talking to people. But a lot of my colleagues literally never have an opponent. I'm not going to name names. Just one guy had an opponent forever.
I'm sorry. I have to stop you there because we're short on time. You've been a wonderful panel. House Republican Leader Brian Newberry, Democratic Consultant Kate Coyne McCoy, and Rhode Island Public Radio Political Analyst Scott McKay. I'd also like to thank everyone at the Providence Athenaeum. And you've been a fantastic audience. So please put your hands together and give yourself a big hand.